Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. The first article is Ask Model Railroader by Cody Grivno. Milwaukee, Racine, and Troy Western Terminus. Question: what was the western terminus of your HO scale staff layout, the Milwaukee, Racine, and Troy? Signed, Phil Steed. Answer: Jim Kelly explained the concept behind the Milwaukee, Racine, and Troy in Meet the MRNT in the December 1989 Model Railroader. Quote: you may have already guessed that the initials in MRNT stand for Model Railroader and Trains. Finding town names starting with M and R was no problem, but T was a stretch. Troy is an unincorporated village about 25 miles southwest of Milwaukee and just west of the better-known East Troy, home to a trolley museum. The MRNT is a hypothetical bridge line extending from Milwaukee to Fort Madison, Iowa. The line's lifeblood is interchange with the Burlington Northern and the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, giving heavy machinery and other goods manufactured in the southeastern Wisconsin a quick start on journeys west. Much of the eastbound traffic is destined for Europe and Africa via the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway. The MRNT's main selling point is that it avoids Chicago. The modeled portion of this fictional railroad extended from the Port Marquette Terminal in Milwaukee to just beyond Williams Bay, about 50 miles that were represented in a little less than 3 scale miles on the layout. End quote. In the same article, Andy Sparandio wrote about the second MRNT located in our former Waukesha, Wisconsin offices. Quote: the new MRNT will follow the same concept as the old railroad, and the operating schematic will be similar too. We like the railroad that the old MRT evolved to be. End quote. Though we've built 2 versions of the MRNT in HO scale and 1 in N, none of the layouts have featured Fort Madison, Iowa. Question: in the August 2025 Model Railroader magazine, there was an article on page 22 about using a Sonicare toothbrush magnet for an uncoupler. Could the author explain where the magnet is within the brush head and how he removed it from the toothbrush? Signed, Rich Bond. Answer: I contacted Paul Rising, author of Rare Earth Uncoupling. He replied, quote, I certainly can explain, but a picture may be easier. One needs only to unscrew the brush wand. The magnet set, parentheses, 2 magnets on a metal base, close parentheses, is at the opposite end from the brush. I use a utility knife to cut the set at the plastic base on which it is glued. When the magnet is free, it will snap onto the knife blade. Be careful you don't cut yourself getting the magnet off the blade. These have serious grabbing power. End quote. Question: my layout is set in 1956 and I'm considering adding a cement distributor such as Walther's Medusa Cement. I have a small fleet of Atlas PS2 covered hoppers to bring the bulk cement to the plant, but I don't know what kind of trucks would have been used back then to carry the product to the local ready-mix retailers. Do you have any insights? Signed, Tim Barnard. Answer: back in 1956, cement was transported one of 2 ways, in 100-pound heavy paper bags, loaded in boxcars, or on flatbed trucks and in steel dry bulk tank trailers. Transporting bulk cement by highway was in its infancy back in the 1950s. Cement is heavy or dense and usually messy because of cement dust generated during loading and unloading. So the dry bulk trailers used in the service were, and are, dedicated and relatively small, typically between 1,400 and 1,600 cubic foot capacity. Loading is achieved by dropping the cement into the top of the trailer with a loading hatch for each of the pockets or compartments. The blower unloading of bulk cement wasn't started until the 1960s and continues yet today because it is relatively quick. Prior to that, augers were used instead of the venturi effect of the blowers. Some trailers had augers along their bottoms that pushed the cement out the back of the tank. Other locations required augers that were placed under each pocket of cement trailer. The cement plants then had augers to get it into the storage tank and ultimately into the batch plant. Signed, Mont Switzer, founder, Switzer Tank Lines, Incorporated. Question. I would like to feature modern automobiles on my under-construction layout. Is there a manufacturer that makes vehicles from the late 1990s to modern day? If not, is there a way to make them? Signed, Jake, via email. Answer. You didn't specify your modeling scale, Jake, but there are multiple companies that produce vehicles appropriate for the 1990s to present in N and HO scales. Some brands you'll want to check for 1 to 87.1 offerings include Athearn, Atlas, Brachina, Busch, Classic Metalworks, Diecast Masters, First Gear, Herpa, Iconic Replicas, Promotex, Rapido Trains, Tonkin, William K. Walthers, Viking, and Woodland Scenics. For contemporary 1 to 160 vehicles, check out Atlas, Diecast Masters, Iconic Replicas, Oxford Diecast, Rapido Trains, and Viking, among other companies. Even if your layout is set in the modern era, it's okay to have some older vehicles on your layout. If you're modeling a downtown district, you could have a group of classic vehicles gathered together as part of a car show scene. For additional inspiration, check out Building Vehicles for Model Railroads by Jeff Wilson, Kalmbach Books, 2018. Topics covered in the book include plastic, metal, and resin kits, converting toys to scale models, and truckloads. Stack 'em up. We received additional comments regarding the questions on 20-foot intermodal container loading practices in the September 2025 Ask Model Railroader column. Larry DeYoung wrote, quote, "My friend, National Model Railroad Association Master Model Railroader Jim Dahlberg, was responsible for intermodal fleet management at Conrail back when I worked at CR many moons ago. He told me that 20-foot boxcar containers exist mostly because they weigh out before they cube out. In other words, they carry dense commodities. Often, when you see a 20-footer on the highway, it's on a chassis with a three-axle tandem instead of the standard two axles, indicating that it's a heavily loaded trailer. Therefore, it is entirely possible that placing loaded 20-foot containers on top and in the well would overload the intermodal car. It could also destabilize the car's center of gravity. It is also possible that when you see a 40-foot or longer container on top of two 20s, it is an empty or carrying a low-density commodity. If you can read the data on a well car, you may see specifications for the amount of weight to be carried in that particular well and how the containers are required to be stacked." End quote. Jesse Munoz, a longshoreman at the Port of Los Angeles and president of the Belmont Shore Model Railroad Club, added that stacking cones are used on the corners of intermodal containers. Walkways on well cars provide access to the cones that secure 20-foot containers in the well to 40 and 45-footers in the top position. The lack of walkways in the middle of cars would make it difficult to safely reach the cones if 20-foot containers were stacked on top of each other. F-Scale Take 2. In the September 2025 issue, we replied to a question on F-Scale. It was brought to our attention that the answer needed clarification. The Chester and Beckett is FN3, not F scale. Model Railroader contributor Jim Providenza added, quote, F scale, FN3, and other large-scale standards were developed by the NMRA in cooperation with many stakeholders in the early 2000s. F-scale and FN3 are both 1 to 20.32 proportion. This proportion is used almost entirely by those modeling 3-foot gauge railroads like the Chester and Beckett Railroad. FN3 uses the Common Garden Railway 45mm, or 1¾-inch gauge track. The NMRA standard for FN3 track gauge is 1.766 inches minimum and 1.793 inches maximum. For F standard gauge, the track gauge is 2.783 inches minimum and 2.845 inches maximum. The next article is Step by Step by Cheryl Sassy. Swinging into Autumn with Hand-Built Oak Trees. Our 7x17-foot O-scale narrow-gauge Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes Railroad is built on a series of modules surrounding a double-sided backdrop. The layout is a closed loop that represents two locations on the SR and RL in Maine. On one side of the layout is Kingsfield, where it is late spring / early summer. The village of Strong, on the opposite side, depicts late fall / early winter with barren trees and a few melting snow piles. While I was building a number of full foliage hardwood trees for the Kingsfield side of the railroad, my husband, Lou, asked if I would try making some leafless hardwoods for the late fall scene. One in particular needed to be well detailed because it was on the lawn of the Forster home in Strong and featured a tire swing hanging from its branches. As it turned out, while visiting with our good friend Bob Hamm and his wife Pat, Bob offered me a few clumps of pepper grass he had picked in Colorado for making trees. Once we returned home, I found that by not being pickled, as commercial varieties of pepper grass usually are, it was much easier for me to remove the small, leaf-like flowers from the stems. So, with a fresh batch of pepper grass in hand, I was ready to start building late autumn trees for the layout. Step 1. Building the trunk. I began by wrapping clumps of pepper grass together with floral tape to form the basic trunk and crown of the tree. Editor's note, dried natural pepper grass is used in floral arrangements and home decorating and may require some searching to find it online. End note. I included a short length of pipe cleaner with each of the stalks as I wrapped them with floral tape. See figure 1. Adding the pipe cleaners allowed me to bend the branches to almost any angle I wished. Since I needed at least one horizontal branch on which to hang the tire swing, the pipe cleaners made it easy to do. With the clumps assembled into the basic tree, I next wrapped additional branches with floral tape higher up the trunk to form the larger arms of the tree. See figure 2. Once I was satisfied with the configuration of the tree, I trimmed the bottom to the desired length with cutting pliers. Next, I cut off the head of a number 2 finishing nail and pushed it into the base of the tree in figure 3. The nail makes it easy to hold the tree while working on it, as well as to plant it on the layout later. I also use it to fix the tree to the styrofoam block that I use to hold trees while working on them, as will be shown in step 3. Step 2. Modeling an oak tree. Since I wanted this tree to represent an oak, and oaks do not lose most of their leaves in the fall, I removed just 75% of the foliage. The color, undyed pepper grass, foliage is a close match to dead oak leaves, so for this type of tree, the natural material works well. I used my fingers to thin the foliage on the tree to the desired amount in figure 1. Where the leaves were removed, the remaining branches on the pepper grass have what I refer to as webs at their tips, which can give the tree a furry look when finished. To limit this effect, I used a small pair of scissors to trim some of the webs away at the tips of the defoliated branches in figure 2. Knots and cut branches give a tree character. These are places where branches were either lopped off by someone or they broke off at some point during the tree's life. I made the knots and cut branches from my tree by trimming short lengths of small twigs I found outside. I then attached them to the trunk with white glue. I held these small parts in place with fine tweezers until the glue set enough to hold them while it dried completely. See Figure 3. Step 3. Acrylic tree bark. With the knots and cut branches secure, I used a stiff oil painting brush to apply a blend of Mars Black, Titanium White, and Raw Umber tube acrylics to the trunk and branches of the tree in Figure 1. I used multiple layers of acrylic paint to increase the thickness of some of the lower branches and blend them into the trunk as well. Next, I built up the roots of the tree using more acrylic paint. To begin this step, I mounted the tree into a foam block covered with wax paper. The wax paper prevents the acrylics from sticking to the foam and makes it easier to remove the finished tree from the block later. I then used a palette knife and a brush to sculpt the root system at the base of the tree using more artist acrylics. Working from photos of real trees can be helpful during this step. See Figure 2. Once I was happy with the general shape and position of the roots, I added some texture to the tree's bark using a stiff pet grooming brush. You need to do this step while the acrylics are still somewhat soft but not wet. I made light grooves on the trunk and roots by gently drawing the brush downward over the surface. Be careful not to overdo it. If you do, however, you can make repairs by applying more acrylic paint. See Figure 3. Step 4. Hand-painted details. Once the acrylics dried, I used a soft bristle brush to hand-paint the trunk and limbs with a mix of grimy black, reefer white, and Roof Brown Model Master water-based paints. This allowed me to carry the color of the bark higher up into the tree and into the smaller branches, see Figure 1. The last step is to dry brush some highlights onto the bark. I used an acrylic concrete color for this step, applying it with a stiff bristle brush. I also used darker colors to put shadows in the deeper areas of the trunk, particularly between the roots and where the branches meet. After allowing the paint to dry thoroughly, I removed the tree from the foam block and peeled away the wax paper, gently prying it away from the roots, see Figure 2. You'll likely have some excess acrylic around the base of the roots that acts like flesh on a metal part. I used a small pair of scissors to trim the material away, see Figure 3. Finally, I applied a light spray coat of Tester's Dull Coat to the entire tree. I then used a Wiseman Model Services cast metal tire and some thread to make the swing and hung it from one of the branches. I planted the finished tree in the front yard of Ruth Forster's home on the layout. Although you wouldn't want to build a forest using trees with this level of detail, the techniques shown here are easy to accomplish over several evenings of modeling work. And as the opening photos show, the realistic results are worth the extra effort. The next article is Starting at the Top at the NMRA. President Gordy Robinson shares how he started with the NMRA and where he hopes to take it. By Eric White, photos as noted. Back in the spring, we had an online conversation with Gordy Robinson, president of the National Model Railroad Association. Much of that conversation was posted as a video on trains.com, but there was more to the story. We wanted to share how Gordy came to join the NMRA and how those experiences helped guide him as he rose through the ranks and took a larger and larger role in the organization. Gordy is interested in North American railroading, and one of his early models was an Athearn quote-unquote blue box, Bud Rail diesel car, which he recently found in a box of things his parents had kept. Quote, "When I was a youngster, well, I'm still young, but when I was a real youngster, when I was a child, and I was reading Model Railroader as a child, I couldn't have imagined, I mean, I had an RDC that had rubber band drive, and I loved it. But I can't imagine then, when I had that, having more than just a headlight and taillight, just having a directional headlight that turned on because the train was going forwards, I thought was great. So I had rubber band drive RDC, and I thought it was awesome that it had directional headlights. So, like, the light was on at the front of the train, the direction it was going. How awesome was that? And now we've got locomotives with step lights, editor's note, ditch lights, marker lights, everything lights, potentially even individual lights on the dash in the locomotive cab in the future. End quote. Finding his people. Gordy told us he grew up in a model manufacturer's household. While that exposed him to model railroading on a regular basis, his interests went beyond the family business, and being around products for sale wasn't always the ideal situation for a child fascinated by trains. Quote, "My father was a manufacturer of brass O-scale two-rail passenger car kits. They were British, of course. But passenger car kits and locomotives. I was going to train shows from being 4 years old, helping on the booth and selling models and assembling kits on the weekend and things like that. But I was never allowed to touch them, editor's note, the kits for sale, because everything had value. This is the problem with being a manufacturer's child. Everything that you touch has a value and it's for sale. So you're in a house full of trains, but that's a business. It's not the hobby." End quote. Gordy's interests needed another outlet. Quote, "I was operating layouts at the shows, and that was great, but I needed to find my own avenue to model something that was unusual. So one of my dad's friends, who helped us pack the kits and helped in the business, took me one Saturday to an NMRA meeting in Manchester, which was not far from where the British region of the NMRA actually held its first meeting in August 1945. He took me to that group, and I was just completely accepted by that group as a 14-year-old. End quote. Gordy was in awe. While he was interested in North American railroading, there was no easy way to get information about the trains on another continent. Quote, "I didn't know what I didn't know. The internet was a thing, but it wasn't like it is now. Just understand that for anyone younger, if you wanted to learn about things, you read a book. I learned about the United States from an NFL 1990 annual at my elementary school, and I knew about the Miami Dolphins and these New England people, and then obviously was strongly attracted to the Green Bay Packers because they were a proper team. So that's it. All of a sudden, I was there, at the meeting, and I was surrounded by these strange-looking models that I couldn't see with my own eyes on local rail lines. We had a railway line that ran just at the back of where we lived. So the American trains were so unusual, not the same as what I could see. And my dad used to, I tell this story all the time, my dad used to send me with, say, $5, the equivalent of £5 of the Queen's money, to go out on a Saturday with his friends and his family. And for £4, I could buy an Athearn Blue Box kit and get, it was like a cone of, we called them chips, but you'd call them fries, for my lunch from the chip shop. And I'd get my kit, and then the guys just sat there and helped me assemble it. They'd tell me all about the railroad. They explained how railroads worked, how interchangeability worked, which wasn't really a concept in the UK at the time, where it was a nationalized railway. It was all one railway, one railroad company. They explained all that." End quote. Gordy was quickly finding his people. Quote, "I got my 15 minutes of the meeting where I could run my trains around the modules that we had set up, and I absolutely loved it. And those guys would spend so much time sitting down with me. And still, all through my adult life, a lot of them have passed away now. I think there's only two or three still with us from that time when there was about 30 people. But they still all sit down with me like I'm 14 or 15. How am I doing? What am I doing with the NMRA? What am I doing with my modeling? What have I learned this week? and they always encouraged me to go and learn something and then come back and tell them something. They sat with me and gave me a like, wow, these guys are as invested in me and they want me to be invested in them because they want me to go away and learn something and bring it back to them. Just like they're teaching me. It was outstanding, and that's what the NMRA was to me. Now, it's not the experience of everybody, but that foundational experience I've always carried with me and always had this willingness and want to give back forever for my entire time since then. They never, when I sat with them, they never told me what the NMRA was. End quote. Gordy didn't know about the membership or that the meets cost money to enter for non-members. Quote, it took me 18 months of going every month to realize that there was an entrance fee because they all paid it for me. It's that kind of willingness and openness to just give everything that you have to another model railroader that really became entrenched in my psyche of what I view the NMRA as, and I think we've lost our way with that, and I'm trying very hard, and so is the rest of the leadership of the national organization, to bring that back, to bring that kindness back to the organization, that kindness back to the hobby. End quote. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader Magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@AfterSight.org. Thank you for listening. Thank you.